Welcome to part two of Oncology Nursing Update, Bispecific Antibodies in Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with nurse practitioner Miss Amy Goodrich from Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. To begin, I asked her to provide a general overview of follicular lymphoma.
So follicular lymphoma is a typically slow-growing, chronic, low-grade lymphoma. The vast majority of patients will present with advanced stage disease. And in this day and age, many people are diagnosed incidentally because they're having imaging or testing done for some other medical problem. And so because it is a chronic, slow-growing disease, we follow the GELF criteria and treat when patients have symptoms or there becomes a problematic area of disease. And so there's a good bit of observation and watchful waiting, active surveillance with this patient population. And that's definitely something that's a little difficult for some people to wrap their heads around. They require a lot of education and reassurance that if they're not having symptoms and the disease is not problematic, that it really is safe to observe them. We do educate patients on the criteria for initiating treatment and, you know, talk about that every visit. And as time goes on, it gets easier for patients to feel comfortable with that. But we are always giving them updates on therapy, updates on clinical trials, updates on what we might be thinking about if and when they need therapy.
And what's for the patients who do require treatment, what are some of the options of therapeutic approaches? I guess BR is a very common, bendamustine rituximab.
Correct.
What are the common approaches?
So chemoimmunotherapy is a common first treatment for patients. There are certainly other options, things like lenalidomide and rituximab that you can use for elderly patients or those with lots of comorbidities. Even just some single agent rituximab might be appropriate at that point and not using chemoimmunotherapy. This is definitely a disease where we customize to the patient. There's really no cookie cutter here because we have a wide breadth of options, both at initial therapy and in the relapsed refractory setting. So you are really, talking to patients about the pros and cons of each of those options. Shared decision-making is a really important aspect here as well, because every regimen is going to have different side effects, different visit requirements. So patients being involved is definitely an important step here along the way as well.
I guess the most common therapy that people do get is bendamustine rituximab. What do you typically see with that? Do most patients respond? How long do they respond for?
Right. So most patients respond well. Most responses in the follicular lymphoma space are partial responses. Complete responses are not common enough that's what we expect to see, although we do see some complete responses. Most are partial responses. Patients generally tolerate bendamustine and rituximab well, can certainly have all of the usual chemotherapy side effects, but this tends to be a more well-tolerated regimen than some of the other things that we use. And then you can also follow bendamustine and rituximab up with maintenance rituximab. We usually give that for 2 years if patients are interested in that approach as well. Some of the long-term issues with bendamustine and rituximab are infections, hypogammaglobulinemia. Patients can develop cytopenias. Typically, neutropenia is what we see in patients after BR and getting maintenance rituximab. So they're not without toxicity by any means, but in the grand scheme of oncology, this is a relatively well-tolerated regimen.
So you mentioned rituximab, which of course has been a big part of the therapy for quite a long time. And I guess during the COVID pandemic, there was a lot of concern about using anti-CD20 antibodies in terms of maybe potentiating more COVID infection or more difficult COVID infection. Where do we stand now in terms of CD20 antibodies? Are people still shying away from it now that COVID is, you know, kind of not as big of a problem? Are we still using it quite a bit still?
Yeah, that's a great question. So back in the days of COVID, when the vaccines became available, we did offer patients the option to stop their maintenance rituximab to give a 6-month washout before we gave vaccines. In this day and age, that is really not such a big concern because so many people have been vaccinated or have had COVID infections and have had exposure to COVID in one way or the other or both. So we're really not doing a whole lot of holding of anti-CD20 monoclonals at this point.
And then in terms of second line therapy, you know, I guess the most common scenario is a patient gets a BR, maybe they get BR maintenance, and then they're observed again without any therapy. Oftentimes for quite a long period of time, although some patients will relapse earlier and those people are more of a concern. But you mentioned the R-squared regimen of lenalidomide or rituximab, which we know is a common second choice for systemic therapy. What do you see there in terms of tolerability and efficacy?
So the efficacy is very good. The efficacy is definitely good with rituximab and lenalidomide. Toxicity-wise, there's great variation in the toxicities that I see in patients. The lenalidomide is usually given for a year, and dose reductions are very common, mainly because of cytopenias. You can see some blips up in transaminases as well, but the cytopenias are really the primary issue that I see that requires dose reductions. Most people do not end up on the same dose that we start them on, and I definitely let people know that up front so they don't feel like they're failing or their therapy is failing. I make sure patients are aware that those dose reductions are very common with lenalidomide and rituximab.
So, of course, there are clinical trials going on all the time with new agents and new strategies. But for now, still, these are two of the most common initial treatments that people get. But after that, it gets a lot more complicated. And now we're starting to get into the arena where these bispecifics come in. But before we get into bispecifics as well as CAR T, what are some of the other therapies that are used, again, third line and beyond? Tazemetostat is an example, but what are some of the therapies that you all use besides bispecifics and CAR T?
Right. So tazemetostat is definitely something that we are using in our follicular lymphoma patients. You know, all of the whole buffet of options, basically anything that you haven't used before, you can use, you know, in any of these lines of therapy. So that whole list of things still, you know, if you start somebody on single agent rituximab and then go to some chemo immunotherapy and then R squared, you could do tazemetostat, you can do mosin, we have epcoritamab now. You know, there really are a whole array of options.
So I want to get more into bispecific antibodies in this, particularly in this situation, so third line treatment, which I think is really a very common situation where at least they're thought about. If you have a patient who's going to be considered for a bispecific antibody, what are some of the things that you keep in your mind that you explain to patients about what these actually are, how they work, what kind of tolerability, in general, before we get into the specific agents, generally speaking, how they work and how they're tolerated?
So I start with reminding them about rituximab or obinutuzumab, and typically we're using rituximab. And they are all aware that it's a monoclonal antibody, and I do educate all of my patients about how it hooks onto CD20. And, you know, 80% of patients have infusion reactions with their first dose of rituximab. And so I remind them of that, and I remind them of the cytokine release and the mechanism of that rituximab infusion reaction. And then I talk to them about the bispecifics and how they hook on to that same CD20, but also hook on to CD3, which are those T cells that come in and cause those fireworks of sorts. And that's how I explain it to patients, that, you know, the cytokine release, even with rituximab, is like fireworks in their immune system, harnessing their best fighting cells. And so I really frame it as this is a bigger fireworks display with cytokine release, because we're directly harnessing those T cells that are responsible for a lot of those infusion reactions. And they tend to that makes sense to them, right? That we're just more effectively harnessing those excellent fighting cells to come to the lymphoma.
And again, before we get into more specifics about the agents that are used right now and approved for follicular lymphoma, another related question is CAR T therapy. And of course, it's very different in follicular when we get to diffuse large B cell, but CAR T therapy is approved. And again, how do you explain to patients how CAR T therapy works compared to a bispecific, and how you decide whether you're going to go to a bispecific or CAR T, for example?
Right. So that is a great question. I still use that same framing about cytokine release using rituximab as the basis of that. But when we talk about CAR T, we're talking about genetically modifying their cells, and so that cytokine release being a much higher incidence and higher grade. We're talking about the time commitment, the caregiver commitment, the not driving for 2 months commitment after CAR T. We're talking about neurological toxicity with CAR T. And so those are some of the things that when patients are getting to that third line, we are talking about bispecifics and CAR T, and the long-term data for both of those, and the time commitment, the side effect profiles, the caregiver requirements, just the interruption in their life, you know, the commitment that they make. And we definitely talk to patients about the fact that, because most of these people will be eligible for both of these, that doing one first and the next second is okay. You're not closing doors. But it is definitely a multi-step conversation that we have with patients. A lot of it depends on how far they live away. Can they relocate versus just spending a night here and there for bispecifics versus relocating for CAR T? So there's a lot that goes into it, including the science and the data, but also the impact on the patient's life and their support system.
And I guess really in contrast to diffuse large B-cell, a very different story. Of course, diffuse large B-cell, a lot of people get cured with chemoimmunotherapy as first-line treatment. And even CAR T therapy has maybe curing people. It looks like it's curing people. Where I guess follicular, you don't really think about cure. As you say, is a lifelong, kind of reminds me a little bit of CLL, kind of a lifelong problem that you're going to try to convert into a chronic disease type model. But there you don't see, you know, it appears to be cure with, you know, CAR T, for example. And so I hear people saying usually that the patients are getting bispecifics first. Is that your experience?
We have been leaning toward bispecifics first, and that's attractive to patients as a first line. And I think a lot of them are hoping that the bispecifics will give them enough of a remission and a time off therapy that something else will be available, and maybe they can push off CAR T and that bigger commitment. And I think to date, that has been a relatively realistic goal is you know, to get people into a remission for a number of years and then have other things to offer them.
And a really good example is bispecifics that came along in the last few years. They weren't available, you know, 5 years ago. So Right. Who knows what might be available in the next 5 years. One other issue I wanted to bring up, I'm curious of your thoughts about in terms of follicular again, is the idea of transformation from follicular to more a large cell lymphoma that acts much more aggressively and often might even take the patient's life, much more difficult to treat. Sometimes you can see patients who kind of have a mixed picture. It looks like follicular, but also a little bit like diffuse large B cell. What I'm hearing about that is those patients usually are treated like diffuse large B cell if they're thought to be transformed. How do you decide whether or not the patients transform? Maybe they have a history of follicular lymphoma, then they transform. Some people present that way. How does transformation sort of enter into the issue?
So typically when, and you're right, some people can present with transformed disease, but typically it's a patient that we've been following. And what we see is growth of one area of disease way out of proportion to the other areas. Oftentimes patients will have symptoms. They will have a high LDH. Lymphomas secrete LDH, and they do that when they're rapidly growing, and that's not typical in follicular lymphoma. At that point, we do PET scans, and if we see an area that is lighting up on the PET scan above and beyond all the other areas, we biopsy. And we really try to get tissue diagnosis as much as possible and not make assumptions about transformation, because like you alluded to, the therapy paradigm completely changes. They go off the follicular lymphoma, if you're thinking about the NCCN guidelines, they go off that guideline and they go on to the diffuse large B cell guidelines with really more aggressive therapy, things like CAR T, bispecifics, transplants, definitely a more aggressive paradigm.
So I believe we have three bispecific antibodies currently approved in non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Can you talk about the agents that are approved for follicular, how they're administered, what the similarities and differences are?
Mm-hmm. So we have mosunetuzumab and epcoritamab for follicular lymphoma. The similarities are that they are both stepped up. So this is a very common thing with bispecifics, that patients start out with small doses and then get two or three doses before they go to full dose. And that is to reduce the cytokine release incidence and severity. Mosunetuzumab is given intravenously. Epcoritamab is given subcutaneously. And in the follicular lymphoma space, there is no required hospitalization for the administration of these drugs. Mosunetuzumab is given up to 17 cycles. Epcoritamab is given open-ended. So as long as patients are responding and are tolerating it, they can continue to get epcoritamab indefinitely, but eventually they stop responding or have toxicity, but there's no maximum number of cycles for epcoritamab. But in terms of side effects, they're very similar in terms of what we're seeing with side effects. So even though the administration is slightly different, there are more commonalities than differences.
And how do you generally decide which one of those two that you're going to be using? I know it seems like mosunetuzumab is used more often. I don't know if that's because it's used, for a shorter period, a temporary period of time, or it's thought to be better tolerated. But how do you decide which one you're going to use?
Right. So epcoritamab is very recently got approved for follicular lymphoma. And so and we've been using epcoritamab with diffuse large cell, but we have been very comfortable and we have been using mosunetuzumab for a number of years now. And it is very effective. It's very well tolerated and is the primary go-to. We are talking to patients about both. We definitely have more long-term follow-up data on the mosunetuzumab patients than epcoritamab. Patients do like the side effect profile of both of them, but do like the finite schedule for mosunetuzumab, although certainly both of them are great options.
So as you referred to a couple times now, cytokine release syndrome is the main issue in terms of tolerability that comes up with these agents. And maybe you can go into a little more granularity about the types or grades of cytokine release that you see and how the management, I guess this really started, we first got exposed to this through CAR-T, but yet, and as you were saying, it seems like the cytokine release of the bispecific is not as intense and difficult with CAR-T, but what are some of the manifestations of cytokine release syndrome that are seen clinically?
Right. So cytokine release, the number one hallmark is fever. And so if patients just have a fever with no hypoxia or no blood pressure changes, that's a grade one. And so those are the patients that we can consider managing as outpatients, just giving Tylenol, doing an infectious disease workup, right? Because all of these patients are at risk for infections. So any fever cannot be just assumed to be cytokine release. We've got to do a good infection workup. And so if patients have no signs or symptoms of infection and you're getting a chest x-ray or chest imaging, or they don't have focal symptoms and you're culturing them, and this really does look like grade one cytokine release, again, it's acetaminophen and close outpatient monitoring. This is where I draw the line, right? And where really most places draw the line. So if patients have a fever with any other issues, right? So headaches, blood pressure changes, any level of hypoxia, those people are getting admitted. In most worlds, unless you have a 24-hour urgent care area where you can support these patients as outpatients, they're getting admitted because they require intensive monitoring. Most of them will get tocilizumab. This is where, you know, higher levels of support than you can do in the outpatient setting, which is where I work, need to be triggered, is an inpatient admission where they're getting more intensive monitoring and therapy.
So another issue that was seen with CAR-T, and you know, I don't hear too much about this with bispecific, but I'm curious, are neurologic problems, you know, so-called ICANS that we see with CAR-T. To what extent do you see that with bispecifics? And when you do see it, what do you see?
So it's very, very low volume, and it is very mild. I've seen patients with little tremors, very mild, maybe a little bit of memory issue, but I have never had, to date, I'm knocking wood, I have not had anybody have significant ICANS with our lymphoma bispecifics.
So another issue that comes up are infections, response to vaccinations, preemptive use of anti-infectives with bispecifics. What do you see there?
So we encourage patients before we start therapy to make sure their COVID boosters are up to date, that they've had their flu shot, if they are eligible for RSV or they need their shingles vaccines. We try to give patients time to get up to date on their vaccines, because we know that once we start giving these drugs, we have no idea what their response to those are going to be. So try to keep people up to date on vaccines while they're off therapy. In terms of infections while on therapy, we tend to, especially in the folks who are heavily pretreated, now I know you're talking about using this in third line, but we've all got lots of patients who this is fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth line that they're getting. You know, we do tend to prophylax against PJP and viral, you know, with acyclovir or valacyclovir, prophylax there. Patients may need growth factor while they're on these drugs. And then the other thing is hypogammaglobulinemia, which you can see with bispecifics as well as CAR-T. So they may be requiring IVIGG supplements, you know, replacement therapy. That's definitely something to be thinking about. Patients can reactivate CMV. So you really have to keep your thinking cap on with infections and looking for infections and culturing and being on top of infections with these folks.
With that as a background, let's take a look at a case that you have here. 79-year-old patient. Can you kind of maybe just summarize? I know this patient ended up getting mosunetuzumab, which you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But can you kind of summarize how she presented and ended up on mosunetuzumab?
Sure. So she was diagnosed several years ago in 2016. She was a rarity with stage one disease. She got involved field radiation therapy, and about 50% of patients with stage one disease who get involved field radiation therapy will not relapse. But she was among the 50% that did, and she relapsed pretty quickly outside of the radiation field. She was working full time at this time, so wanted something kind and gentle that wasn't going to interrupt her life. We gave her rituximab weekly times four. She got into a partial remission that lasted about a year and a half, and then so we gave her rituximab again. She did not respond. She got lenalidomide and rituximab. She responded initially and then progressed. She did not have a mutated EZH2, but really wanted to try tazemetostat because it's easy to take. It's so well tolerated. The response rates are about 35% for patients who have normal or wild type EZH2. So not surprisingly, she did not respond. And so at that point, we said, you know, we've got to jump into, you know, chemoimmunotherapy. You've not had chemoimmunotherapy. She got four cycles of bendamustine and rituximab. She got into a complete response, but it didn't last long. So 10 months later, she's progressing. She goes on to be observed for a short period of time and developed this bulky parotid mass. It was about 7 centimeters. We biopsied it. She did not transform. And so we started her on mosunetuzumab, and her tolerance. Okay, so yep, you can see this parotid mass that this lady has. You can see that there on the left of your screen. It's pretty obvious, this parotid mass. She gets mosunetuzumab, and she developed grade 1 cytokine release, so just fever, no blood pressure changes, no hypoxia, no other symptoms. She never had to be admitted. She took acetaminophen for a couple days, and the cytokine release resolved. And then she has gone on to tolerate it beautifully since then. So the way mosunetuzumab works is that after 8 cycles, you do another imaging, and we used PET on her. And her PET, after 8 cycles, she was in a complete response. That parotid mass really melted almost immediately. It was really remarkable. We don't often get to see such remarkable reduction in invisible nodes in our lymphoma population. And so she got 8 cycles, and the protocol for mosunetuzumab says that if you get a CR, a complete response, after 8 cycles, that you stop. So we've stopped, and she is doing beautifully. So this is a lady who was very heavily pretreated and had gotten, you know, very short responses with everything, and has really had a remarkable response to mosunetuzumab with really good tolerance.
So really interesting. I guess the only site of disease she had was in her parotid gland. What did she? Could you see it? Was it bothering her? Did she have pain in it? What did it look like?
So it wasn't painful, but I mean, you could see it across the room. It was she's a very small lady, so a 7 centimeter mass, you know, on her neck was definitely visible. She had small nodes in other places, but that was really the trigger for therapy. Not only the location, but the size of that mass. She was not having pain, but it was cosmetically, you know, very disturbing to her. She's a very active 79-year-old. She's involved with lots of community organizations. She volunteers. You know, so mosunetuzumab was definitely a good choice for her.
And how long has she been off therapy at this point?
She has been off therapy for about 3 months now, and she's doing beautifully. So hopefully this holds her for a while.
I would imagine both you and her feel a lot of gratification about what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This was really a very effective treatment for her. It's really nice to see when we have, you know, folks who are very heavily pre-treated. And at this point, we would be happy if she responded to anything. But the fact that she got into a complete response after those 8 cycles was really wonderful.
All right. Well, in a second, we'll get to your second patient, which is a 62-year-old man with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. But before we do, again, as we just did with follicular lymphoma, I kind of like you to take a step back and talk again a little bit about how these patients typically present, how they're treated initially, and you know what usually happens when you see recurrent disease. I mean, some of these people, unlike follicular lymphoma, actually are cured with chemoimmunotherapy. So can you talk about, again, how they usually present and are treated?
Sure. So diffuse large cell is the most commonly diagnosed lymphoma in this country. It is a fast-growing disease, and unlike our slow-growing diseases, the fast-growing lymphomas are curable, right? And how I explain it to patients is that chemotherapy kills cells that grow quickly, so you can conceivably kill all of those cells, unlike the low grades where there are always cells that are in their resting phase. But diffuse large cell initial therapy is chemoimmunotherapy. This guy was diagnosed in 2021. So initial therapy options include CHOP and CHOP-like regimens. We now have polatuzumab, Pola-R, CHP. That was not FDA approved when this guy got diagnosed. But you know, the goal of therapy is to cure, and the goal of that initial therapy is to cure patients. The ones who are cured, it's a great day for them. The ones who aren't, unfortunately, have stories very much like this patient. So he was diagnosed in 2021, and he had very extensive disease. He had lots of adenopathy, and he had this soft tissue mass invading his T9. He had bone involvement. So this guy had a lot of disease. We did not treat him initially, but he got R-CHOP for 6 cycles. He got intrathecal prophylaxis because of his advanced stage disease. He achieved a complete response, and then they followed up with some radiation to this T9 soft tissue mass, and he maintained this complete response for a couple years. He relapsed in 2024 with this gluteal mass, and he also had bone involvement at that time. And so he came in to see us. And you can see on the left, his left hip area, that gluteal mass that was lighting up. And that was his pre-glofitamab scan. And then this is his post-glofitamab scan. So you can see that light up is gone. So he really had a very nice response to glofitamab. But if we go back to what happened to him, when patients relapse after their initial therapy, if they relapse within a year, you can use CAR T second line. If they relapse in more than a year, CAR T becomes third line. So because this guy had such aggressive disease and extensive disease, we really wanted to get him to transplant for curative intent. So we gave him rice, and we had hoped to get him to autologous transplant. But in order to get to autologous transplant, where the backbone of that therapy is chemotherapy, you really need patients to be chemosensitive, and he was not. So we gave him rice, and he achieved less than a partial response. So doing an auto transplant was not going to be an option for him. So then we pivoted to one dose of polatuzumab and gave him CAR T in hopes of really inducing a quality remission. So he progressed within 4 months of CAR T. So what are curative options for patients at this point? So that allogeneic transplant is the only curative option for this guy. So we started glofitamab. We gave him three cycles, and that's where that PET comes in, that he had that hot spot in that gluteal mass. He got three cycles of glofitamab, and that induced a complete response. And he is currently undergoing allogeneic transplant. So this is somebody who we very successfully bridged to transplant with glofitamab. And, you know, hopefully this guy does well. You know, he's 62. He still works. He's an anatomy professor, so he understands the gravity of all of this. You know, hopefully he does well, because after this, we don't have good options for this guy. There are some tri-specific antibody studies that are going on that we could refer him to, but he would definitely be a clinical trial or, you know, comfort salvage situation after this.
So I'm going to go through the bispecifics that are currently being utilized with diffuse large B-cell in a second, but first just to pick up on a couple other things from the history, just to sort of provide some, you know, sort of a little bit of background. One is you talked about the fact that the hope initially was to go to autologous transplant, where chemotherapy, high-dose chemo, really is the essence of the treatment. That didn't work too well, and he ended up going to an allogeneic transplant. Can you kind of explain what an allogeneic transplant is, how it works, how you do it, and what patients' lives are like once they have that therapy?
Sure. So allogeneic transplants are transplants from someone else, and it's typically a family member. He got a transplant from his daughter. And so the backbone of that therapy is how I explain it to patients is that as their immune system does surveillance, it does not see the lymphoma as being foreign and doesn't attack it. Our immune system should attack cells that don't look right, and their immune system misses cells. And to get somebody else's bone marrow means that someone else's immune system takes over and can see any lymphoma that's left as being foreign and attack it. And so the big issue with allogeneic transplants is that in that state where the new immune system is looking for the lymphoma, it's agitated and it looks around and it says, we're not home. We need to attack this home or host. And so graft, the new immune system versus host, the patient syndrome is one of the biggest complications with allogeneic transplant. So we do lots of allogeneic transplants and we do lots of haploidentical, meaning partial matched allogeneic transplants. We do a lot of them as outpatient. We've got a great specialized clinic situation, but it is a very big commitment. Patients need a caregiver. If they live more than an hour away, they need to relocate to be close to us. Some of them are in the hospital for a period of time, and then they come in and out of our intensive clinic setting. The fatigue that patients have is beyond anything that they have ever had before. These are some of the things that I make sure patients are aware of. They're on prophylactic medications, anti-infectives for a year. We also see lots of infections, lots of hypogammaglobulinemia. That graft versus host disease is definitely a real risk for those patients as well. So it is a huge commitment. We tell everyone you should plan not to work for 6 months. After this transplant, the caveat is if people can work from home and they can work remotely, many of them get back to work a little more quickly. But teachers or people who go into offices, they don't work for 6 months. And then the other thing that's very common is patients just having a little bit of chemo brain and really not being able to concentrate for quite a while after transplants, especially the allogeneic transplant. But, you know, in a nutshell, it is a very big commitment. But for this guy, this is his only curative option at this point. And so, you know, when patients are faced with you know, just palliation or something that can cure them, many of them do opt for transplant. Not all of them, but many of them do.
And of course, I think for elderly patients or people with comorbidities, allogeneic transplant is often not used. But either way, I am curious if you could talk a little bit about the available bispecifics. He got glofitamab. I think epcoritamab that you were talking about before is also available. Mm-hmm. You talked about that with follicular lymphoma. And most patients, if they're going to get CAR T, you'll get it before the way he did. Unfortunately, unlike a lot of patients who got great responses or even maybe cured, he just progressed right through it and got the bispecific. Again, if they're going to get CAR T, if they're not too old or have too many comorbidities, and then have the progression after that, they often will get a bispecific. So can you go through again the two bispecifics that are utilized, what's involved in terms of patient care from the nursing perspective, what the patient experiences?
Right. So we've got glofitamab and epcoritamab. And again, stepped up doses. The biggest difference with glofitamab is the first part of glofitamab is a dose of obinutuzumab. And that, again, is to debulk, and it's to reduce cytokine release, to just sort of quiet things down a little bit. We really wanted him to get glofitamab because his disease had not seen obinutuzumab, and we thought maybe we could get a little more bang for our buck giving him both the bispecific and that obinutuzumab. And so he did have grade 2 cytokine release. He did get admitted. He got a couple doses of tocilizumab. It got under control pretty quickly. And then he went on to tolerate the glofitamab well, which is really what we're commonly seeing. And clearly this guy got a great response with the glofitamab, and, you know, enough so that we could get him to his last curative option.
And again, how would you compare what happens when a patient gets glofitamab versus epcoritamab?
You know, it's very similar. It's very similar. Other than the obinutuzumab, we've got our step-up doses. They both require a hospitalization. Both have a 24-hour hospitalization requirement. And again, that's if you don't have a, you know, some sort of high-intensity 24-hour area, which I don't have the luxury of that. So he did get admitted. And it was during that admission that he developed his cytokine release. So the cytokine release issues are higher with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma than follicular. Both of these agents have a planned admission because of that cytokine release. So it's not like if you choose one versus the other, you're avoiding an inpatient stay. They both require that. And then, of course, odronextamab is our next one that's coming. It's not FDA approved yet, so we'll have to wait and see what that label says. But hopefully we'll have a third option for these folks soon.
Right. And then how long is treatment given?
So glofitamab is given for up to a year. So glofitamab is time limited. But in this guy's situation, we were right. Using this as bridging. So we're never thinking about doing this for a year. Although we are thinking that depending on what happens after the transplant, we could go back to glofitamab, but we'll see what happens.
But for patients who aren't going for allogeneic transplant, you stop therapy at a year. What about with EPCO? Yes. Do you continue it?
Yep, epcoritamab is open-ended. Like in the follicular lymphoma space, epcoritamab, you keep giving it as long as patients are tolerating it and they're responding. Glofitamab is a one-year therapy, again, as long as they're responding or not having intolerance.
So you said he had grade 2 CRS. Specifically, what exactly happened?
So he, during his inpatient hospitalization, his planned inpatient hospitalization, he developed fevers and some blood pressure changes. He never required vasopressors, but did need fluid resuscitation, got some tocilizumab, and quickly did did well and got under control. That's a very typical story. Most patients do not require vasopressors. They can, but most patients do not. Patients can have hypoxia as well. He did not, but that would also be, you know, something that would be managed inpatient.
Did he require ICU?
He did not. No, he did not. We've gotten better with managing CRS, especially places that do CAR T. We jump on cytokine release much earlier than we were years ago. And so we're not hesitant to give TOSI, to give tocilizumab, to shut down that IL-6 and get that cytokine release under control quickly. We're much more aggressive with treating cytokine release today than we were, years ago when CAR T was relatively new. We were all learning at that point, but now we're better at it. But this is something that as these drugs move into the community, our community partners can learn from our evolution, and there are now resources and documents and guidelines on how to handle this as well. So we're in a much better position than we were just a few years ago even.
So let's chat about your next case, a 58-year-old patient. And I know there's a lot of complexities here to this patient. We were talking about transformation. I guess he has transformed low-grade or follicular mm-hmm. lymphoma. But can you kind of sort of, without going through all the details of the case, kind of maybe summarize what happened with him?
Yeah, so he was a guy who started out with follicular lymphoma and got quite a few lines of therapy for many years before he had biopsy consistent with transformation and came to us. So this is when he came to us when he had transformed disease. So this guy was a challenge because he was a real loner and was really one of the most profound cases of lack of just absence of social support completely. So he was divorced, who had no relationship with his ex-wife. He had no children. He lived alone. He had no support system, no friends. He was estranged from his entire family. He grew up in an abusive family and had no contact with anyone, literally had no one in his life. And so this is a guy that could have gotten CAR T, could have gotten transplanted, but they require caregivers. So he got referred to us when he transformed. We gave him R-CHOP, so something very along the lines of diffuse large B-cell therapy. He remained PET positive, so was clearly not cured of his diffuse large cell, and we biopsied everything to make sure. So after his R-CHOP, he got polatuzumab with bendamustine and rituximab, and again, we could not get this guy into a complete remission. His biopsy again showed diffuse large cell. He got tafasitamab and lenalidomide with initial response and then progressed while on therapy. And so at that point, all we had were bispecifics to offer this guy. And so he did get epcoritamab for 4 cycles. He did not need a caregiver with epcoritamab. He got 4 cycles and he ended up dying of disease progression. The silver lining here is that the time that he was getting these palliative therapies, I really worked with him and so strongly encouraged him to reconnect with someone in his family that he did reach out to his sister and did establish communication with her before his death. He did not want to reconnect with his mother or his brother. His father had died years ago, but did reconnect with his sister. And ironically, his mom called me a few months after he died. She had gotten my office number from his sister, who I would communicate with. And she was just so upset that he didn't reach out to her and that she didn't know how sick he was. And I feel like he would have had way more support had he just you know, reached out to people. But he's really a very sad example of how social support drives options, right? He could have been someone who had been cured or had long-term disease control with some of these more aggressive therapies like transplant or CAR T, things that required caregivers. But it was just really heartbreaking to take care of this guy. He was, you know, kind of a like abrasive, snarly guy, but there was real warmth inside of him that you had to dig deep to find. But I guess the win was that he did, you know, get back in touch with his sister and did establish some sort of relationship with her before he died, and we got him that time to do that. But he was a really tough, tough case.
Yeah, I'm curious what it was like when you first met him, how he came across to you. I mean, it sounds like you were able to penetrate his space more effectively than anybody else. And I'm curious how you did that and what you were thinking about as you first got to know him.
Yeah, so the first day I met him, he was like yelling and just, he was mad. He was angry. He really didn't want to die. He wanted to be treated. He wanted therapy. And so it really took several visits for me to, you know, just figure out how and why he was in this situation with no social support. And he really talked about eventually his very traumatizing childhood, and he had a very, very bad relationship with his brother. The brother, you know, was emotionally abusive to him. It was just really, it was heart-wrenching every time I saw this guy, but I tried to get in a little bit more every time I saw him. And I saw him a lot during this therapy. And I think he understood that I really did care about him and I wanted him to do well and I wanted him to have quality of life and the longest life that he could. I don't know what I did or how it happened, but I did finally convince him that he needed to reach out to somebody, and he did. You know, and I know his sister was very appreciative. His mom felt very left out, but I had a small win, and that was good enough.
Did you ever think about or recommend counseling to him?
Yes. And he was paying out of pocket for COBRA and did not have mental health benefits and didn't want to spend money on mental health benefits. I did have social work involved as much as possible, and they were following him and they were, you know, helping him where they could. But he was not willing to pay out of pocket for mental health counseling, but he desperately needed that.
Really very, very interesting. Just in the remaining couple of minutes, anything else that you want to add to what we've talked about today about bispecifics or taking care of people with lymphomas in general, or anything you want to add to what you said about this last patient in terms of, you know, sort of the biopsychosocial model?
Yeah. So I mean, when I think about bispecifics and CAR T, but you know, we're specifically talking about bispecifics, I think about all the patients that have gotten these therapies, and particularly bispecifics, who, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, they would not have survived long enough to even get to these therapies. And now we have so many more treatments for these patients. You know, when I started in oncology, we really had very little for these folks. And it has been such a wonderful evolution to have these drugs and to have these different options to offer patients, both in the follicular space and in the diffuse large B-cell space. I think that bispecifics fit a great need in this patient population. Again, for patients who have lots of comorbidities or don't have the social support system or the capacity to relocate for CAR T or transplants or things like that, our bispecifics are still very effective, and they are not as demanding on the patient and the caregivers and their families, and they don't require the end organ function and just sort of fitness, the physical fitness that some of the other like CAR T or transplant would require. And so I just think that this is going to explode. And to me, our biggest challenge right now is figuring out how we can get these step-up doses in patients at tertiary centers, and then begin moving patients back to the community to continue getting dosed when the CRS and the ICANS rates are extremely low. And I know we'll get there, but you know, in most practices we're not there yet. But I'm really looking forward to being able to have patients go back to the community and continue to get these bispecifics closer to home.
I mean, I think for follicular lymphoma and drugs like mosunetuzumab, I could envision a scenario not too long in the future where they're going to get started in treatment in a community-based oncology setting. I mean, that's what I'm hearing.
Yes, I agree with that. I think the real issue here is that all of these bispecifics recommend access to tocilizumab and ICU level care. And so coordinating that with your local hospital and your, you know, your local emergency department and your local hospital is really the, because I feel like if the local oncology offices could completely do this, they would be doing it. It's that tocilizumab and ICU access that require a lot of coordination outside of the regular oncology office.
Right, but again, I think, again, for a patient with low-grade disease, if follicular lymphoma is getting mosunetuzumab, I mean, sure, you potentially maybe will end up in a ER, et cetera, you know, in a hospital setting, but it seems like the vast majority of these patients are just going to cruise right through it. I mean, actually, yes, less toxic than a lot of other therapies that we use. So
yeah,
I think it's
agree.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen a lot of therapies start this way and then end up in the community setting, and a lot gets done in that setting.
Yeah,
anyhow,
I agree.
We'll see what happens.
I agree. Yeah, no, we'll get there. It's just gonna take a little time, but I mean, these drugs are here to stay. So we'll just get better and better at making them more accessible to patients.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are a lot of trials now looking at bispecifics earlier, including first-line therapy. So as you're saying, we're just going to see more and more of it. And so we have no choice. We got to learn how to use it.
Right. And now we have GemOx with epcoritamab in second line for diffuse large cell. So yeah, they're moving up in lines of therapy. I agree with you.
All right, Amy, thanks a lot as always. It was great. I learned a lot as I always do from you.
It's always good to work with you. Thanks for having me.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Ms. Goodrich, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Nursing Update, Bispecific Antibodies and Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma Edition.